The headlines this hour. More Iranian political figures, including Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Raisi, Vice President Ishaq Jahangiri, and former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, declared their bid for the presidency. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas targets Tel Aviv with tens of missiles in response to Israel's attacks on the Al-Shati refugee camp. And fresh rallies are held in several countries in condemnation of Israel's war in Gaza and its deadly crackdown on protests in the West Bank. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The fifth and final day of the registration process for potential candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential election is underway. The Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Ebrahim Raisi officially declared his bid for the presidency by turning up at the headquarters of the Interior Ministry in the capital, Tehran. Other notable figures registered today include Vice President Ishaq Jahangiri, the former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, former IRIB Chief Ezatollah Zahrami, and the Chairman of Tehran's City Council, Mohsen Hashemi. A series of other high-profile hopefuls have also filed their nomination papers over the past 5 days. Ex-President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and former ministers Rostam Qasemi and Hossein Dehghan were among those names. Candidates have to wait for final approval from the Constitutional Council. Iran's presidential election is slated for June the 18th. Iran's Judiciary Chief Ebrahim Raisi held a press conference right after filing his nomination for entering the country's presidential race. Let's take a look at part of his speech.
It is right that the judiciary is an important task and responsibility. There is another important point on the priority, and that is the executive branch. Seeing the livelihood problems that people are facing, the issue of unemployment, high prices, inflation, the livelihood of people, and the economic situation of the society, I'm telling you, people's livelihood is a major concern. And there are some despair that exists in different parts of society. All these can be tackled in a strong administration. This despair can turn into hope in a strong administration. With the existing potentialities and manpower, young manpower in the country, and using all the mental and spiritual resources that we have in our country, people's concerns could be settled and people's sufferings could be allayed, and that this despair can turn into hope.
Iran's former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani has called for more solidarity and unity within the country. He made the remarks during a press conference at the Interior Ministry after officially registering for the upcoming presidential election.
Some people only aim to disintegrate the nation. We need more unity and strong willpower and tolerance inside the country to resolve problems. If there is no unity, we won't have stability, development, and calm. Another point is resolving the complex international and regional issues. If those issues are prolonged, they will harm the lives of people. The country's foreign policy should be aimed at facilitating foreign relations in order to boost the economy. We don't need a person who just chants slogans and increases the problems of the people. We don't need those who seek their own populist goals. We need to run the country with logic and strong management. Good governance depends on fewer slogans, effective rationality, and strong executive powers. Reluctance and false ideas will not bring the required peace and economic development. Justice is a pillar of the country's economic development, not with a slogan, but with applicable theories.
Islamic experts say justice means providing a foundation for the growth of the people's talents, and that cannot happen without a balanced competition between all members of the society.
Chairman of Tehran's City Council, Mohsen Hashemi, says if elected president, He will seek a policy of détente, as his late father sought when he was in office 3 decades ago.
It is clear that if we want to bring about an economic growth of at least 8%, as stated in the country's development planning, we have no choice but to move in an international atmosphere better than the current one, and with a better relationship. I would like to mention the conduct of Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani with regards to regional and neighboring countries as well as all other nations, which was based on détente. He would use all domestic and foreign resources and capacities to resolve the country's issues. I will certainly try to follow in the footsteps of Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani on international affairs.
In other news, Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with its warplanes, naval boats, and tanks, causing more deaths and destruction in the besieged Palestinian territory. Earlier, Israeli jets targeted the Al-Shati refugee camp in western Gaza, killing 10 Palestinians, all of them women and children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the attack, describing it as a full-blown war massacre. Also, Israeli jets once again pounded residential areas in Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The regime's naval forces, as well as artillery units deployed near Gaza, also shelled the coastal strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza says at least 139 people, including more than 60 women and children, have been killed since Monday. Over 950 others have been wounded in the attacks. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon says Israeli warplanes, tanks, and naval forces continue to pound the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli fighter just continue to pound the Gaza Strip, and Israeli Navy and tanks also attacking the Gaza Strip. The, minutes ago we heard that a residential tower was also hit with a drone rocket in preparation to completely destroy it. Israeli forces have been doing this since Monday, since day one of this onslaught. And it seems the Israeli regime is determined to kill as much Palestinians as possible during its attacks. Despite the Israeli attacks and the increase of the volume of the Israeli attacks, Palestinian resistance groups are not sitting idle. They're retaliating. Just seconds ago, several rockets were fired towards the Israeli regime to. And the resistance groups immediately after the attack on the Shatta refugee camp fired volleys of rockets in retaliation against the Israeli regime.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has targeted Tel Aviv with tens of missiles in response to the regime's attack on the Al-Shati refugee camp. The group's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigade, says it has also launched drone and mortar attacks on Israel's Kisufim military base near the Gaza Strip. Hamas has recently stepped up attacks on Israel in response to the regime's aggression on the besieged territory. Israel's Ramon Airport, as well as cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod, have also come under missile attacks. The head of the Hamas political bureau says Israel's attack on the Al-Shati refugee camp is indicative of the regime's helplessness facing Palestinians' resilience. Ismail Haniyeh stressed that Hamas will continue to defend the Palestinian nation against Israeli crimes. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have staged rallies protesting Israel's deadly aggression against the people of Gaza. The rallies were held in and around Ramallah on the occasion of the 73rd anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, or Catastrophe Day. That's in commemoration of forceful eviction of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homeland following the creation of Israel. Protesters chanted anti-Israel slogans demanding an end to the regime's decades-long occupation. They also called for an end to attacks on the Gaza Strip. The West Bank has been a scene of deadly clashes since Monday. Israeli forces have killed at least 14 Palestinians and injured over 500 others in the occupied territories. Fresh rallies have been held in several countries in condemnation of Israel's deadly crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and its aggression against the Gaza Strip.
Israeli occupation of Palestine, it can only happen with U.S. support, and so I feel like there's an opportunity now for the people of the U.S. to stand up against the continued occupation and the continued support of the U.S. for the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Protesters in New York City called on the U.S. government to stop funding for Israel, whom they describe as an apartheid entity. They carried banners and placards with one reading Zionism as terrorism. In the Australian city of Sydney, thousands of people came out in solidarity with Palestinians. They also chanted slogans against Israel's occupation of Palestine. Cities around the world, including Washington, D.C., London, and Istanbul, have witnessed rallies over the past week as Israel ramped up its aggression. Palestinian political commentator Nur Udeh says the colonial regime of Israel has not been punished for its crimes against Palestinians because countries like the U.S. provide political cover for it.
This colonial regime has not faced any consequence because there are countries that are still determined to provide it with political cover, not just with economic assistance and military assistance, but with political cover in international organizations. We've seen the U.S. obstructing the convening of the Security Council. We've seen them halt and obstruct even issuing a press statement on behalf of the members of the Security Council. And it's not just the United States. Frankly, there is an overall international failure to apply the standards that are supposed to be universal on Israel. There is an exceptionalism that Israel has been allowed to enjoy ever since its inception, whereby it can commit whatever crimes it wants to in order to entrench its colonial regime while being rewarded for that behavior, for those crimes, and protected from even verbal recrimination. That's why these acts of dispossession, I wouldn't even call them eviction. Eviction would imply that there's, you know, a different owner of those homes. Those families are the rightful owners of the homes in Sheikh Jarrah. And I'll tell you something else, and this is important for the viewers to understand. Israel has a law by which Palestinians who have deeds to their homes that from which they were dispossessed in 1948, they cannot claim those homes. While Israeli settlers and settler organizations who enjoy tax-exempt statuses in the U.S. and in other countries can come and claim those homes, claim that land, even with falsified paper, and there are cases where that happened and where the courts would rule in their favor and dispossess Palestinians. So this is by no means an issue of real estate, and the exposure of that lie, of that fallacy, of the fact that these courts are but an instrument in the machine of oppression and persecution of the Palestinians, I think put Israel in a very delicate position, one that it's not used to being in the past. And that's why, despite everything and despite the attempt to reduce what's happening into a conflict and to only talk about rockets and so on and so forth, there's an overwhelming pressure internationally to focus on the real issue, which is the continued Nakba of the Palestinian people, the continued dispossession of Palestinians.
The coronavirus outbreak continues to take its toll in India, with the number of infections and deaths rising rapidly there. Daily fatalities stayed near the 4,000 mark on Saturday, bringing the overall toll to well over 266,000. The country also registered more than 326,000 new infections, but the lowest in nearly 3 weeks. The overall caseload stands at more than 24 million. The World Health Organization warned that the second year of the pandemic could be worse than the first. The announcement came after the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi sounded the alarm over the rapid spread of the disease. However, cases have fallen steadily in some states where stringent lockdowns were imposed. The ongoing Windrush scandal continues for many in Britain to contradict the claim that the country is free from institutional racism. British black communities face wrongful deportations and difficulties claiming the compensation and justice they are owed. The situation is so bad that other migrant communities in the UK are expressing a lack of confidence in securing their own statuses. Our UK correspondent Richard Sudan has more.
The wrongful detainment, deportation, and denial of legal rights predominantly affecting Britain's Caribbean communities, known as the Windrush scandal, first made headlines several years ago, mostly impacting the generations who had legally migrated to the UK between the late 1940s and early 1970s. Despite government promises to tackle the problem, many more in Britain's black communities continue to be traumatised by government policies, which critics characterise as racist, and which were recently slammed in a High Court ruling, which suggested that Home Office rules impacting those affected by the scandal were irrational and in some cases had even led to the unlawful denial of British citizenship.
What it shows you is that this government has put tripwires at every stage of this application process in order to weed out and disqualify people who suffered enormously, but they needed an administrative excuse in order to deny them compensation. And that the High Court has ruled against the government is a huge disgrace for this government. But they won't be feeling any shame, because this government and Boris Johnson and Priti Patel in particular seem to take great glee and delight in revelling in racism.
Other Windrush victims are still fighting to get any justice or government support, with one even saying that they had had more support from the local supermarket than the Home Office.
We've had ruthless deportations of Jamaicans who committed no crime other than parking fine and lived here for 20, 30 years, got their families here. All the evidence shows us that when it comes to British immigration policy, it is ruthlessly targeted on the non-white, the African and Muslim and Asian communities. And of that, I don't think there can be any doubt.
The Windrush scandal, which first made headlines several years ago, continues with more deportations likely planned in the near future, with the government remaining squarely in the spotlight with thousands of people demanding action.
The Windrush scandal, almost exclusively impacting Britain's black communities, continues to have a devastating effect, with the government appearing to have taken no serious action to stop the injustice. Richard Sudan, London.
And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
When the believers saw the Confederate forces, they said, "This is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us, and Allah and His Messenger told us what was true." And it only added to their faith and their zeal in obedience. Chapter 33, verse 22. When we face a difficult circumstance, we should not become agitated, and we should not make others agitated. This is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us. They had already told us that if we move on the path of the truth, we should expect this. Likewise, did we make for every messenger an enemy, evil ones, among men and jinn, inspiring each other with flowery discourses by way of deception? Chapter 6, verse 112. We should not be surprised at these things, because they have already told us about them, and we knew it in advance. When such circumstances arise, this ayah manifests itself to us and shows us the path we should take in life. There are many other ayahs and examples in this regard as well.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Allah, 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 All
One of the issues that occupies my mind as an official in the system is the ayah addressed to Hazrat Yunus, Jonah, God's greetings be upon him. He made a move out of desperation and exhaustion as his people did not respond to his invitation. Then Allah the Exalted said to that prophet, who had gone through a lot of trouble for a lifetime and who had worked tirelessly all his life, and remember Dhun-Nun when he departed in wrath. He imagined that we had no power over him. Chapter 21, verse 87. He thought that God would not be strict with him, but God was indeed strict with him, as a result of which Hazrat Yunus was disciplined like that. When I feel inactive and passive, whether I get this feeling myself or feel that other officials suffer from it, I remember this ayah. He imagined that we had no power over him. We think that such negligence and inactiveness will not receive a harsh response from Allah the Exalted, but this is not the case, because this might happen to us and show itself in reality.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Africa Today.
The people of Nigeria are paying a deadly price for importing Europe's dirty fuel. The government of this most populous country in Africa has failed to stop the importation of these toxic heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. Tens of thousands of Nigerians die every year due to pollution, and now the masses are saying enough is enough. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are going to focus on how Nigeria is importing dirty fuel from Europe. This fuel is having devastating effects on the health of Nigerians and the country's environment. In the second segment of our program, we're going to talk about the ongoing conflict over Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric dam being built on the Nile River. This project is opposed by Egypt and Sudan. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi recently warned Ethiopia of risk of conflict over its giant dam.
I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt. Because all options are open.
So join us till the end of our show as our experts analyze these issues.
Europe selling dirty oil to Nigeria. The Nigerian government has since 2016 been making repeated promises to end the importation of dirty fuel from Europe. Members of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, convened a two-day workshop in Abuja in June 2016 with the plan to end the use of dirty European fuels in their countries. According to a non-governmental organization known as the Stakeholder Democracy Network, Nigeria is plagued with some of the worst air pollution levels on the planet. In a report, this NGO noted that apart from damaging vehicle engines, the dirty fuel is having a detrimental impact on public health and national air quality. A Nigerian affected by pollution emanating from this dirty fuel speaks out here.
You wake up in the morning to black particles surrounding us and making us unhealthy.
For more on this subject, we have contacted J.C. Martin Manfur, a senior project officer for the Stakeholder Democracy Network, SDN. He was involved in SDN's research on toxic fuel. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's quite surprising to many that Nigeria, an oil-rich country, imports dirty fuel from Europe. What's the reason for this, Manfur?
It's surprising. Nigeria exports sweet, low sulfur fuel and gets in exchange of imports of highly sulfurous fuel. The reason is not far-fetched. The refineries Nigeria have are unable to produce enough fuel for the domestic consumption of Nigerians. So to subsist for this, the government has no option than to import fuel to augment whatever that is produced within the country. That has resulted in this this situation whereby a large bulk of the fuel that is being consumed in Nigeria is either imported from Europe or the ones that are artisanally refined within the country, which the government still term as illegal.
According to some estimates, Nigeria imports approximately 900,000 tons a year of low-quality, toxic heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. According to some reports, the fuel being refined illegally in the bushes of Niger Delta is of a higher quality than the petrol imported into Nigeria from European countries. Now, why has the Nigerian government failed to fulfill its promise of ending the importation of dirty fuels from Europe?
It all has to do with structural, because Nigeria at the moment has four refineries, four government-run refineries, but they are poorly maintained. The government has put in a lot of money in towards the maintenance of these refineries. But what has happened is that it turns out to be a corruption-laden process where money is pumped into the refineries and they never get to produce anything. So that has hindered the ability of the Nigerian government to be able to stop the importation of dirty fuel. Currently now, the government is relying on a new refinery that is being built by Dangote Refineries, one of the richest men in Nigeria, to produce most of the domestic consumption of fuel in the country.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Manfur, and stay tuned for more.
The European Union says it has adopted ambitious new targets to curb climate change. However, in a clear case of double standards, low-grade diesel imported from Europe to Nigeria exceeds daily EU pollution limits by up to 204 times. For petrol, the pollution emissions are around 43 times higher than legal EU levels. David Ovalar, the executive director of Africa Network for the Environment and Economic Justice, has been leading a campaign to stop the importation of dirty fuel from Europe to Nigeria.
The Swiss trading companies and other companies that are importing dirty fuel into Nigeria need to know that they do have a corporate social responsibility that is expected from them, that they should help to bring clean fuel to Nigeria.
Now, Nigeria is among many African countries still using dangerous, low-grade, high-sulfur fuels, which have long been banned in Western countries. So why are European countries dumping this dirty fuel in Africa?
I think it's cheaper for the process of refining fuel to remove the huge sulfur. It's more costly when compared to exporting it as it is. And unregulated markets such as Nigeria and the West African sub-region leaves open the opportunity for people to sharp business practices to send this thing to unregulated markets such as that in West Africa. So it's left for Nigerian governments to make sure that they tighten the standards that they have within the country. Then they will now be able to enforce and ensure that only quality fuel that meets their standards can come into the country. Otherwise, businesses who are looking for ways to maximize profit will always find ways to bring this sulfur-laden fuel into the country.
Clearly, it's up to the Nigerian government to stop these unscrupulous European oil companies from dumping their dirty oil in Africa.
Nigeria now has some of the world's most polluted cities, and this is partly due to the use of these dirty fuels from Europe. This dirty fuel is a major contributor to Nigeria's public health crisis, with the latest data suggesting around 114,000 people die due to air pollution-related causes every year. In Lagos, a World Bank study estimates air pollution resulted in 11,200 premature deaths in 2018 alone.
Now, Mr. Manful, how is this dirty fuel from Europe impacting on the health of the people of Nigeria and the country's environment?
It has huge environmental and health impact. For instance, the city of Port Harcourt, where I live, since 2016, have been suffering from what we term black soot, where particulate matter keeps in the air and goes into the lungs and nostrils of individuals. So we witness cases of increased respiratory-related diseases, asthma, bronchitis, and all that. And this has a huge impact on the healthcare burden in the states. You know, it costs people a lot more to take care of their health. On the environmental part, we have issues of due to air pollution, we have acid rain, which makes the environment unpalatable for people to live in, affecting having impacts on the quality of the building materials that we use in building our homes, on farming and the quality of produce that can be produced from the land, which has become infertile from acid rain.
Well, in a move towards self-reliance in fuel production, Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources recently said the government has embarked on the modernization of some of the country's refineries.
And you can see the milestone that we achieved last week. The Federal Executive Council has already approved the comprehensive rehabilitation of Port Harcourt refineries, and we are on course to rehabilitate Warri and Kaduna refineries.
Now, Mr. Manful, do you expect the situation to improve in the near future?
I'll say yes. Two things and two reasons for that is, first, the ECOWAS sub-region is working with United Nations Environment Programme is trying to push for the adoption of a standard for fuel use within the sub-region. So if this is adopted and member countries begin to enforce them, including my country, Nigeria, then we'll be able to make sure that only quality fuel can be imported into the country if we still need to import fuel. And that way, we'll reduce the amount of sulfur in our fuels that we use in the country. Another thing is what the government is doing now with although it's a reliance on a private refinery, which has about 600,000 barrels per day capacity, which will be able to provide enough fuel for the domestic Nigerian market. And as it has done, Nigeria does not have any need to import sulfur-laden fuel into it because already the country has very low sulfur content crude oil within the country. So we'll be able to solve that problem in the medium to long term.
While clearly the rehabilitation of Nigerian oil refineries will meet the country's domestic demand for clean fuels and curb its reliance on imports. Now we are going for a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the conflict over Ethiopia's giant dam on the Nile. Stay with us.
biggest missions of my life today. We are always walking through this door, but today we are cut off from access to our farm. And our guy, our worker, needs food. So we gotta walk through the door to cross to get to our farm.
To deliver some groceries.
Man, always random things going on. So this is our Ramadan routine. Take you guys through a day in our life of what it's like Ramadan in the motherland. But first things first, we gotta go feed our amazing staff at the farm.
Deadlock over Ethiopia's dam.
Egypt and Sudan failed to reach an agreement at the last round of talks with Ethiopia over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Now, the talks were held in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital, Kinshasa, early April. This latest round of talks was hosted by Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi, who is also the current chairperson of the African Union. Now, Sudan's Foreign Minister, Mariam Sadiq El-Mahdi, told reporters that Ethiopia's insistence on unilateral moves represents a violation of international law.
Ethiopia issued a statement accusing Egypt and Sudan of pursuing an approach that seeks to undermine the AU-led process and to take the matter out of the African platform. Sudan and Egypt have refused to take part in the Nile Basin Comprehensive Framework Agreement unless Ethiopia recognizes their right to oversee the use of most of the Nile waters, which a British colonial treaty of 1959 accorded to them. This treaty is also contested by other Nile Basin countries. The multi-billion dollar Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been a source of tension in the Nile River Basin ever since Ethiopia started its construction in 2011.
Now, for more on the protracted conflict over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, we have contacted Dr. Ashok Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research and UNESCO chair of International Water Cooperation at Uppsala University. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Swain.
My pleasure.
Now, what is the current state of dialogue between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam?
So, three countries have been negotiating to find an agreement of how to fill the reservoirs. This is a big dam, very big dam, how to fill the reservoirs and how to coordinate among themselves. Now for almost more than 1.5 years. And this negotiation has come to a standstill after it failed to get a deal through African Union-led negotiation, which was being chaired by Congo a couple of weeks ago.
Thanks for that insight, Dr. Swain, and we'll be right back.
The filling of the dam's massive reservoir is expected to commence during the upcoming rainy season, which normally begins in June or July. Despite opposition by Sudan and Egypt, Ethiopia's water minister, Selassie Bekele, recently said his country will continue to fill a mega dam on the Nile River.
On second year filling, also it's very clear it has nothing to do with anything. As construction progresses, filling takes place. This is our commonly agreed the declaration of principle. We don't deviate from that at all.
What are the major points of disagreements between the parties to the conflict?
The immediate disagreement or what is going on that for the last several months is whether the agreement will be a binding one or it will be just a memorandum of understanding. Ethiopia is refusing to make this agreement legally binding because I think the real reason, as I understand, is Ethiopia is fearing that if it gets into a legally binding agreement, it might not be able to develop the water resources in the future.
Internationally, the European Union says it supports the African Union in the quest for a negotiated solution on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The United States also recently appointed veteran diplomat Jeffrey Feltman as a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. He is expected to join European powers involved in talks with the three countries.
However, Ethiopian Foreign Minister Demeke Mekonnen has expressed his country's categorical rejection of any attempt to force Addis Ababa to accept a colonial agreement with Egypt and Sudan regarding the Renaissance Dam. Mekonnen says exerting unnecessary pressures on Ethiopia by deliberately politicizing and internationalizing the dam dispute will not force his country to accept an agreement dating back to the colonial era. Now, Dr. Swain, do we expect an expanded involvement of international powers in trying to resolve the conflict?
This African Union-led negotiation, and Sudan has been asking for the involvement of US, UN, and EU. And so Egypt is supporting it, but Ethiopia has been opposing it.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a major US ally in the region, warned of the risk of a military conflict over Ethiopia's giant dam on the Blue Nile after talks ended without progress.
I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt. Because all options are open.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has said his country doesn't have any intention to cause harm to Sudan and Egypt. But he added that Ethiopians don't want to live in darkness. Both sides are clearly sticking to their guns. Are there chances that the disagreements over the dam will lead to a regional military conflict, or diplomacy will prevail?
You know, the threat to any Ethiopian use of water on the upstream have been very regularly being threatened by Egypt before. The one of the good things Ethiopia had done before, when it started building this hydropower dam, that it had brought Sudan to its side. But what had happened for the last several months, that's the conflict between Ethiopia and Sudan has pushed Sudan towards the Egyptian side. So Egypt and Sudan coming together, and I think there has been a number of threats have been issued, particularly after the failure of the talk in Kinshasa. So, but the question is whether it will lead to military conflict or not. I do expect that it should not. It hasn't, because the countries have not fought over the water till now, and I think it will be a huge problem, or particularly for the countries to develop the water resources further if they can engage in military conflict. But considering the situation in the region, you can never rule out anything.
There have been reports indicating that the Israeli regime military has installed the Spider-MR air defense system for the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam amid the ongoing dispute. Israeli regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Addis Ababa in 2016 and said the Tel Aviv regime will assist Ethiopia in benefiting from its water resources.
The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam will be Africa's largest hydroelectric power project once fully operational. It will produce 6,000 megawatts of electricity, twice as much as Ethiopia's entire current output. Now, the dam is expected to give the region a major economic boost. Dr. Swain, how will the Grand Renaissance Dam impact on Ethiopia's economy and the region in general?
It's a massive dam, almost $5 billion dam. It's a hydropower dam, as I said before. It will produce huge amount of hydropower, which Ethiopia is in the urgent need, because Ethiopia is population is growing, Ethiopia's economy has been on the upswing for some years, so it needs hydropower. But I think it will also produce a lot of hydropower. Even Ethiopia can sell in cheaper way energy to Sudan, and even also Egypt can benefit. We must know that the Grand Renaissance Dam is a hydropower dam, so the water is not going anywhere. So it just need to that these three countries need to develop the trust and the trust each other how to cooperate on that dam.
Dr. Ashok Dias says that trust is key in solving the conflict between Ethiopia, Egypt and Sudan over the Grand Renaissance Dam. Now here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted as the conflict evolves. So let us know what you think these three African countries should do to solve this conflict. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of the Friday congregational prayers, Salatul Jum'ah, and our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah? Now, dear listeners, we've talked about how the general congregational prayers are so important in the life of a Muslim, and they are so important for the Muslim society in general. And we've also talked about the great blessings that are within the congregational prayers, especially as regards to our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. Now, in this program, we want to talk specifically about the Friday congregational prayers. If it could be said that the Friday congregational prayers is the king of all congregational prayers. It is a weekly social ceremony of the Muslims, if you will. The Friday congregational prayers, the Salatul Jum'ah, which is said so in Arabic, occupies a very special status in Islam. It has, of course, material worldly benefits as well as spiritual benefits. And dear friends, it is not only an act of worship, but it is also a manifestation, a showing, an announcement, a proclamation of the Muslim's power and the grandeur of Islam. It increases also the awareness of the followers of the Quran, and it is considered to be a religio-political prayer. The Friday prayers are a beautiful example of the Muslims coming together, united, common in cause, all in servitude, in ubudiyah of Allah, the Elevated, the Exalted. Thank you.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'd like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatu Shakin, the whispered prayer of the complainers. Please stay with me. My God, to you I complain of a soul commanding to evil, rushing to offenses, eager to disobey you, and exposing itself to your anger. It takes me on the roads of disasters. It makes me the easiest of perishers before you. Many its pretexts, drawn out its expectations. When evil touches it, it is anxious. When good touches it, grudging, inclining to play and diversion, full of heedlessness and inattention. It hurries me to misdeeds and makes me delay repentance. My God, I complain to you of an enemy who misguides me and a Satan who leads me astray. He has filled my breast with tempting thoughts, and his suggestions have encompassed my heart. He supports caprice against me, embellishes for me the love of this world, and separates for me obedience and proximity.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which was regarding the Friday congregational prayers, the Salat al-Jum'ah, we were saying how these Friday congregational prayers truly have a very special status in Islam. And we also talked about how it is the manifestation of the power of Muslims. Now, dear friends, there are many, many traditions, many, many ahadith, which have been narrated in this regard, and it is really quite impossible to deal with all of these traditions in just one simple program. But of course, that does not mean that we won't talk about these traditions. So we have a very beautiful tradition from the infallible messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, where he has regarded the Friday congregational prayers, the Salat al-Jum'ah, as the Hajj pilgrimage of the poor. Allahu Akbar. God is great. So here, of course, poor people, because they don't have the financial means, they don't have the condition, the prerequisites. In Arabic, we call it the istita'at, the conditions, the prerequisite requirements for attending Hajj, one of which is to have the financial istita'at, the financial requirement to going to Hajj. Poor people don't have that. So are they, you know, disenfranchised? Are they deprived of the honor of Hajj pilgrimage because they are poor? No. Allahu Akbar. Islam says that if you are poor and you have the desire to go to Hajj, attend the Salatul Jum'ah. Attend the Friday congregational prayers, for it is the Hajj pilgrim of those who do not have the financial means to go to Hajj. And so, dear friends, here we see that the Friday congregational prayers when it comes to ubudiyya, has a weight similar to the Hajj pilgrimage. Very beautiful. This tradition, dear friends, can be found in Bihar al-Anwar, volume 89, page 199.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
A look at this idea of fear and grief in the Quran. It's two emotions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions a lot in the Quran. Some of the greatest people in history having moments of stress and anxiety. It's okay to be stressed. It's okay to feel anxious. It doesn't mean that you're not relying on Allah or you're ungrateful towards Allah. It doesn't mean that at all. The other example is Bibi Maryam, another one of the four great women. And this one short verse really, to me, was a huge moment of reflection. She's now pregnant with Nabi Isa, about to deliver him. The pains and the contractions and the pains of delivery is so severe that in the Quran, there's a verse in Surah Maryam itself where she says, Ya laytani mittu qabla hadha. She says, woe unto me, ya laytani, oh my God. Like, she just feels sorry for herself. If only I had died before this happened. If only I had died before, meaning before the pain of this pregnancy, if only I was dead. And sometimes, you know, mothers-to-be, when they go into, you know, labor pains, I mean, you know, it's a severe pain that as a male I could never understand. And sometimes I've seen it with my own eyes, that if they say too much, if they complain too much, then they're right away told by the people around them that, look, don't be ungrateful, this is a gift from Allah, a blessing from Allah, this and that. And meanwhile, she's asked to kind of, you know, quiet down. Here is Bibi Maryam, one of the four greatest women, the only woman by name mentioned in the Quran. And Allah now, fine, it happened in history. Let's say she even uttered those words. For Allah now to place that inside of His Quran as one of the 6,000 plus verses is a lesson for us, especially for my sisters. It's okay to feel that level of pain. Does it make you part of the unfaithful ones? Does it mean that you're ungrateful for the blessing that's about to be delivered to you? No. It just means that you're a human being. It just means that you feel pain. It just means that this is a very difficult process to go through. But for Allah now to record this and to narrate this in His Quran through the likes of Bibi Maryam, to me, I thought was very profound. Again, I, just in the beginning, just want to reiterate the fact that it's okay to feel these emotions. It's okay to go through these moments. The greatest women before you, the greatest people before you had gone through the same thing. Look at Nabi Yunus, for example. Nabi Yunus, a great prophet of God, in the belly of the whale, in that darkness, right, that we recite in